Welcome to week four. Topic number three still, but week four. We're dealing with the age of the universe. If anybody still needs to register, wants to take care of payment and all that, see me afterwards, please. Over the course of our first couple of topics, we talked about reasons why Torah, or the representatives of Torah, or Jews, or students of Torah, might have problems with scientific claims and claims that seem to contradict lessons that the Torah teaches. So we talked about the issue of divine authority versus what a human being says. We talked about the challenges involved in the scientific model. We talked about arguments that particular laws in Judaism don't necessarily take scientific observation into consideration. New observations will not change the standing law. We talked about honoring tradition. And we also talked about options for reconciling Torah with the observations made by science, or the theories suggested by scientists. We talked about suggesting that perhaps the Torah can be reinterpreted in light of new information. We talked about the idea that perhaps the sages were working with the science of their day and should not be expected to be up to the science of today. We talked about certain cases in which the Torah may say something that seems on the surface to be about nature and observed reality, but in fact it's referring to some deeper idea, and therefore, even if it doesn't match observed reality, that isn't necessarily so significant. And we gave a couple of applications for it. And we're now on our third topic, the issue of the age of the universe. So the core problem, as we outlined it last week, is that if you look at the Torah's account of creation in Bereshit, it seems like the universe is created in 6 days. And when you count up the generations found in the Torah, and then work your way through the chronology in Tanakh, and then count the years since the conclusion of Tanakh, it sounds like the world is 5,777 years old, give or take 165 years. And the sages even spoke, as we saw last week, about a limit of 6,000 years for the world. And the problem, of course, is that that doesn't fit at all what science is observing today and the theories we have to explain the observations that science makes. So, you know, based on current astrophysics, and we talked about it in a little bit of detail last week, I gave you the page from NASA's website, based on the speed of retreating galaxies as measured by the shift of their light, it looks like the universe was created between 12 and 14 billion years ago. Not anywhere near 5,777. The challenges that brings are straightforward. Right? It undermines the whole biblical story of creation. It undermines the 6,000-year narrative that the Talmud presents. And it makes Torah look like this sort of primitive myth of self-important people. Like we're now, this is, you know, we are the center, and the world starts with us and it ends with us. And it just doesn't seem to fit. This what science is saying doesn't seem to fit with what we're taught by tradition. So what we're going to see now are some of the classic responses to this problem and how they fit into what we discussed in the first couple of weeks. So we're going to start with, as we already started at the end last week, with reinterpretation. The idea that maybe the Torah's account was never meant to be taken literally. It was never supposed to be, read this and you will now know the age of the universe. And we already saw last time that there's room to argue that the 6 days of creation are not literal. Right? We noted that if you're going to tell me that they are 24-hour days, you're going to have to explain how it is that you have 24-hour days when you have neither sun nor moon for the first 3 days of creation, so that there's no reason to hold those to a 24-hour period in the first place. There's room to debate that. But that's one point. But more broadly, we saw the quote from Maimonides, which I brought here again as source number one, because it is so important to this conversation. From his Mora Hanavuchim, his Guide of the Perplexed, and I'm going to go through it again because we went through it quickly last time, and because it's a really important point that he's making, and you have to appreciate just how bold he is with this comment. He's not dealing with the age of the universe as an issue. He's dealing with a separate question. Torah teaches that God creates the universe. The Greeks speak of the idea of a world that was always here and will always be here. right, also would be rejected by science. But that's the claim that he's dealing with, what's called in Hebrew, kadmut ha'olam, the idea that the world was first, so to speak. And Maimonides says, we don't believe that the world was always here, but we don't, our issue with it is not, well, it contradicts biblical verses. Our issue is that philosophically it's wrong. That's Maimonides' point. He says, as a philosopher, I reject it. It doesn't make sense. But if you were just to say to me, ignore the philosophy, what do you do with the fact that the biblical text doesn't agree with it? He says, I could deal with that one easily. I could reinterpret the entire biblical text, not only so it doesn't contradict it, but so it actually supports it. Which would be quite a trick, right? Because the biblical text does begin in the beginning of God's creation of the heavens and the earth. So how in the world are you going to reread that in order to say that the world was always here? I don't know, because he never had to do that. Because he didn't believe philosophically that this was correct and therefore worth justifying. But he says, we've already done this in another debate. If you look at numerous biblical texts, it makes it sound like God is, in some sense, physical, material. Right? We speak of, I mentioned last week, the hand of God as one example of it. So how can you speak of the hand of God if God is not physical? And he says, yeah, we dealt with that one. We already reinterpret all of those verses. You can do a lot with interpretation, and don't assume that the literal read is what the text actually means. Take a look now at number one again. We'll go through this quickly. He says, know that our flight away from the idea of a first, meaning non-created universe, is not because of the Torah's verses which speak of a created world. That's not why we reject the idea that the world was always here. The texts which teach creation of the world are no greater than the texts which teach that God is physical. And the gates of interpretation are not sealed before us. They are not withheld from us regarding creation of the universe. He says, we can still reinterpret what we read in order to fit what we observe about reality. We could explain them as we did in distancing the idea of physicality, the idea that God is physical. And it may even be much easier. And further, we could explain those texts to support the idea that the universe was first, as we have explained texts to distance the physicality of God. So not only can we prove that the texts don't contradict it, we can have them supported if we want to. It's that malleable. In truth, what causes us not to do this and not to believe it are two factors. And then he goes into his objections to the idea that the world was always here. Now, inevitably, this leads to a question, right? If you can really do that, if you can play with verses to that extent, so that a verse that says, in the beginning of God's creation of the universe, can actually mean the world was always here, where's the limit on interpretation? So when the text says, to my eyes, right, that pig isn't kosher, right? Maybe you could reinterpret that one also.
And it's been tried.
Has it?
Once I was on in Israel, they used to try to put boards and I don't know, all sorts of shit up to make pig kosher.
But they weren't reinterpreting the verses.
Well,
I mean, that people have declared it.
But there are ways that we've tried to reinterpret halachot to make them more malleable to our...
Right, so that's actually a key distinction. I'm going to come back to that distinction between reinterpreting verses and reinterpreting halachot, reinterpreting laws, because those are two different things.
What happens one day when they genetically modify shrimp and
oh, that's not one day. That exists. That exists. There actually was an excellent article put out by Rabbi Tzvi Heber of the COR last year on genetically modified salmon and the question of when they put in genes from non-kosher creatures, does it do anything to the kashrut of the creature? And his answer was essentially no. After several pages of discussion, it's kosher. It's not a problem. But but going back to the core issue here of how far can you go, in truth, the Talmud speaks of requiring sages at the highest level to be able to argue that which is impure is pure, and to argue that that a pig will actually be kosher. You have to be able to make that argument in order to demonstrate mastery of not only material, but of logical analysis. At the same time, when you deal with law, you do fundamentally approach it differently than you deal with philosophy. And this is a bigger topic, which isn't really for right now, but I want to note the difference. When you're dealing with law, you also have to deal with fealty to a tradition of interpretation. You have a national history of, this is how we understand this verse, and this is how we practice it. It isn't simple for somebody to walk in, you know, a couple of thousand years down the line and say, actually, I think the law is different. I think this is the way that we should interpret the verse. There's a certain sense of what's called in Hebrew Mesorah, tradition, that needs to be honored when you're dealing with law, which does not pose the same challenge when you're dealing, as Maimonides believes, when you're dealing with philosophy. It's a broader topic, worthy of its own series probably, maybe someday. But that's the distinction. I wanted to take a look at number two. Number two, as you see there, is from Rabbi Avram ben HaRambam. Rabbi Avram, the son of the Rambam, the son of Maimonides, who follows in his father's tradition in terms of reinterpretation and accepting what science has to say. He says, it is not mandated by the great stature of the Talmudic sages and their wisdom, and the completeness of their wisdom in explaining the Torah and its minutiae, and the correctness of their explanations of its principles and details, that we argue for them and uphold their views in all of their statements about medicine, nature, and astronomy, and to believe them in this as we believe them in explaining the Torah. That was a very long sentence, right? It took him a while to get to the period at the end. But it reads, meaning what he's saying is, I can believe that the Talmudic sages were brilliant and mastered Torah, and that their insights were correct, and I can defend all of their arguments in the context of Torah without necessarily feeling beholden to statements they made about medicine, nature, and astronomy, and to give them the same credence. The fact that somebody can tell me this verse teaches me a certain law, and I accept that, doesn't mean that I have to believe him when he says the sun goes around the earth. That's the statement that he makes here. He says, the ultimate wisdom of Torah is in their hands, and to them was given the task of teaching it to humanity, and he quotes you the biblical verse, by the Torah they shall teach you, so you shall follow, etc. So it's a logical extension of what his father has said, in the sense that his father already said, if the scientists told me something, philosophers in his context, if philosophers told me something and I agreed with it, I wouldn't be stopped by the fact that we've interpreted verses differently all down the line. And the son says, yeah, I'm willing to accept that which the thinkers of today will tell me, as long as it's not about what Torah is. Torah is not their province, but science is. And if you jump to the modern age, Rabbi Avram Yitzchak Cook, if you take a look at source number three, he says, the Torah certainly sealed the act of creation, and it spoke in hints and parables. For everyone knows that the act of creation is among the secrets of Torah. If the account were to be understood simply, what secret would there be here? And he says, obviously it wasn't meant to be understood on a basic and simple and literal level. That's not the way it works. It's meant to be understood that this is veiled. There's a lot that is hidden here. And so he says, you have to be open to reading it in a non-literal way. And so that's one school of thought. You tell me the world is 14 billion years old, I can deal with that. How am I going to read it? How am I going to reread it? Maybe the days themselves are not really 24 hours, as we already suggested. Maybe the account of the creation of the different species along the line, day by day, where it starts with the what's created first, after light and all that. We separate out the land and the water, right? And then we move into the plants, right? No, but after light and after you have dry land, right? You move through the plants, you move through the birds, right? You move through fish, I should say, and then you move into the animal kingdom and towards human beings. That is meant to indicate, perhaps, an evolutionary model in which, phase by phase, creatures develop. Now, you have to deal with the fact that the sun and the moon are only coming in on Wednesday. the fourth day. It's very hard to work with that and to have that fit your evolutionary model. There's life beforehand, so the plants can grow. Don't worry about photosynthesis. But that doesn't quite fit. But that's the sort of model that you will see when people say, the answer is, I have to reinterpret what I saw in Bereshit. I can't take it on a literal level. And that's one school of thought. The second approach that we'll look at is an approach which has a few different applications. But one of them, well, the approach is to draw on classic sources and to say, yeah, that's what they were talking about. Not so much to reinterpret as to say, this is what we've believed all along. It's already found in our older sources. It's not new to us that the world is that old. It's actually been part of our doctrine all along. You just didn't realize it. So we're going to see a couple of examples of that. Take a look, please, at source number 4. The text here refers to a verse which may be familiar to you from the Friday night Kiddush. It's the beginning of the second chapter in Bereshit in Genesis. Vayechulu ha-shamayim v'ha-aretz v'chol tziva'am. Exactly. Vayechulu means what? Right? And they were completed, and they were finished. Hashamayim, right? The sky, the heavens. The haaretz, the land. The chol tziva'am. What does that mean? Everything on it, right? The fact that tzava is used to mean an army is because it means the masses, the population. So a tzava comes to be used that way, but it's the... But it means the population thereof. The chalts of Am, everything in them. And that's usually what you'll see in a translation. But the Talmud is bothered by this word tziva'am. Because not everything there is born, so to speak. Not everything has been created. Not everything has come into existence. And it's also a very strange word. It's not the type of word you normally see. The other problem is, well, leave it with that problem. We have enough problems. But the Talmud says, you know, this word tziva'am lends itself to a play on words. What do you mean? Oh, well, that we spelled a little differently. Tziva for color is with an ayin. But take a look at source number 4, what this passage in the Talmud says. Everything created was created at its full height, at its full intellect, and in its full form. It is written, he quotes our verse, and the heavens and earth and all of their host, tziva'am, were completed. Do not read tziva'am, but tzivyonam. Tziva'am doesn't mean their host, their masses, it means their form. In their form, so that everything is created in its full form. Now, I'm not so concerned about, but the word in the text is tziva'am, as opposed to tzivyonam. That doesn't bother me so much. How it is that they do this analysis of the text isn't the point. The point is the idea that they're showing you in the text. The fact that the sage writing here 2,000 years ago says everything that was created in mature form. Right? This answers the classic question. Which came first, the chicken or the egg? The chicken. The answer is, it's created as a chicken. Right? That's the answer. Which makes sense. When you imagine the Garden of Eden, right? When you imagine Bereshit, so do you imagine a world of seeds? Right, no, you imagine that there are already trees around, and there are plants around, and there's a tree with fruit, right? At least two that we know of. Sorry.
They can't grow without the chicken.
Well, maybe it's underneath something warm. As opposed to, I don't know how they... Yes. Dan says the egg needs the chicken.
There's
true.
No evolution. There's absolutely no evolution there. It's the form. The evolution of human and the evolution of the plant. It's there.
Right, so Marilyn said there's no evolution, there's no growth. It's simply, this is it. But I want to come back to that in a second. When we think of Adam and Eve, right, do we imagine them as babies?
No.
No. They... are there, actually, as the Talmud says, they're 20. They're age 20 when the events happen in the Garden of Eden. You know, they're still in that impulsive kind of end of teenage years stage that explains an awful lot about that story. This one is the one you don't want me to eat? So I'm just checking. Their answer is, and they're not answering our problem. In the days of the Talmud, no one is talking about a world that is billions of years old. That's not anywhere near the horizon. What they are saying is that the universe is created in a ready-to-use format. There is no need to wait for things to happen. God creates it in this functional state, which, again, from a logical perspective, makes sense. Why in the world would you create something that you then need to wait for? Right? Why do they just create it in the way that it's now ready to go? But what it also reflects, then, is the idea that there is such a thing as a mature universe. You follow? In other words, that had it been created from scratch, had it started at Big Bang and been allowed to develop, this is eventually what it would have looked like. Eventually, over the course of however long it takes, you would have ended up with a planet like this. You would have ended up with plant life. You would have ended up with animal life. You would have ended up with human beings. And all of this is what it would have looked like. Which begs the question, or pushes the question, of how would it have gotten there? How would you have gotten to this mature universe form? Must be that it's possible for this to happen. That there's a belief that there is such a thing as an evolutionary process. There is such a thing as a way for things to reach this stage. It happens to be that God jumped to the end. But what it also means is that this is going to look exactly like it would have looked had it evolved to that point. So you're going to have all these fossils of dinosaurs that never existed. You're going to have remnants of evolution that didn't actually happen. You will have oil underground and everything else looking as though it got there. Looking as though it got there normally, but in fact, we just jumped in the middle. You follow?
Sort of.
Well, imagine it this way. When you paint a picture, I don't know if you're into painting, Marilyn. No, you're not. Okay. But if you did want to paint a picture of, I don't know, the seashore, right? So you would paint the water, right? You'd paint, you know, draw some lines to be birds, you know, off in the horizon, and you'd put in sunlight, and you'd put in clouds, and, you know, maybe you have people there also, depending on how ambitious you are as an artist. But you're drawing what you see right now, right? This is your snapshot of what's there right now. You're not creating everything and putting it there. You're drawing a picture of what you see in front of you, which got there in our case because people came there, because someone was a child and then they grew up and so on. But all the person sees when they see your picture is a full-grown scene. The suggestion here is that God creates the world and says, why do I need to wait? Why would I create this from scratch and let it develop? This is the world I want. This is what I want to have in front of me. That's what the Talmud here is suggesting. Yeah.
I think what you were saying before was that it could include evolution, that all of the things that happened, and that we start our explanation at the mature universe. We disregard the preamble.
Yeah, that evolution could have happened, but it simply is plunked down as though it had happened. Hypothetically, it could have, but it didn't, because God said, I'm jumping in right here. The Talmud is not answering the problem of the age of the universe. It doesn't know of a problem of the age of the universe. It's making a statement for its own purposes, to say that everything is created ready to go, ready to use. But along the way, it tells us there is such a thing as the world reaching that point on its own. It just didn't need to. Now, the usual argument against this statement is, why is God going to trick people? Why would he put fossils in the ground to make it look like the world looked that old, right? If it actually isn't that old. To which, what's the response? That's the usual challenge, right? What's the answer? Well, no, if you accept the idea that it's not that old, if you accept the idea that it's putting that we're getting here, that the world actually is 5,777 years old, and it just looks the way it would look if it were really much older. And someone says, well, then why would you trick people? To my mind, the answer is, he's not trying to trick people. It's not about tricking people. He's creating a full-grown world, and this is what a full-grown world looks like.
The power of God just reiterates the power of
Hashem. But I don't think...
I don't know if power is the right word, but yeah.
I just think that the answer to me is that it's not about deceiving people. This is what a full-grown world is supposed to look like. It should have fossils, it should have oil, it should have everything else. And so that's what he put out there. In the same way, if you go back to Adam and Eve, right? What is Adam supposed to look like? Adam is going to look like a 20-year-old. And that includes all the things that would have happened had he grown up from birth to 20. Yeah.
White or black? Asian?
Does it matter?
No, if he comes out as just a full-grown 20-year-old and he's the only one, what did he come out looking? That's just an interesting question.
Well, it's a question in its own right. I would assume he looks Middle Eastern of some kind.
No blonde hair.
I would expect not blonde hair, no. I would expect not blonde hair. He probably looks as close to me as possible. minus the white eyebrow, but you know, the question of what he looks like is interesting in its own right. I wasn't sure whether you were going to the question of, well, how did humanity's diversity come about in that period of time?
The first man, and he comes out looking exactly as he's supposed to, is at full grown. It's an interesting question. Based on that, how do all those other colored people come there?
Right, and the question of the evolution of it. Right, the Gemara already was bothered by that. The Talmud asks the question of, you know, how is it that you end up like this in the form, but their answer is more of a declaration. They say, look at the wonders of creation. Normally, if you mint a coin, all the coins that you stamp will look alike. When God creates humanity, they become so diverse so quickly. In other words, rather than ask it as a question, they make it as a statement. Yeah, without knowledge of Mendelian genetics, but that's the but that's what they're doing.
Since we're off on a funny tangent, in the United States Congress, I'm not going to get onto the president, but United States Congress in the 19th century, I think beginning of the 20th century, on two separate occasions, they actually debated, because they had nothing better to debate, whether or not, you ready for it, Adam had an Abel. Now, why would Adam have an Abel?
Right.
If Adam didn't have an Abel, God didn't have an Abel. Because he was made in God's image. So, I'm not going to give you an answer, but I think we spend the rest of the day discussing Adam's navel issue.
Well, navel gazing is fun, but I think we have a couple of other answers to go with.
All right.
But I'm going to go with the assumption that he had one. Because, again, this is what he would look like if he were a normal human being. Even though, correct, there would have been no umbilical cord to connect anywhere. Yes?
So, Robert, we don't have to accept the view of the Midrash, right? They're just speculating on the words
of Right, again, the Midrash is... If by Midrash you mean the read of the word Tziva'am versus Tzivyonam, that's classic Midrash. You know, that's your method of dealing with a word which is unusual and asking what is this anomaly meant to teach me. But the principle that they draw from it is an expression of a way of looking at the world that says there's no reason for this world to start from scratch, and that I think is also bothered a little bit because when Adam and Eve are created, we are introduced to them as thinking, speaking adults. We're not introduced to them as babies. And so the question that you have to ask is, to what extent is that true of the world as a whole? But this is one idea. It's an example of taking a classic source. This passage in the Talmud was learned by millions of people over the course of history. It was never explained in the light of evolution until there was an evolutionary theory. But going back to it and saying, oh, you know what? What this passage is saying accounts for what we observe in the world around us. It turns out our world actually could be as old as everybody says, at least in terms of the way it looks. and not in terms of the number of years that passed, because God didn't start from nothing. He started from, this is what it would look like as a mature functioning world. So that's an approach. Accepted or not accepted as you choose, but that's an approach. One of the other approaches, which is more famous, is the multiple worlds theory. When I was in school, in day school, I think I was in, I don't know, grade 6, grade 7, they showed us a movie which was about this, although I was not old enough and sophisticated enough to realize what the problem was they were trying to solve. But they thought, evidently, that this was on our mind. They showed us a movie about this. I remember very little about it, except that, you know, it was during class time, so I was happy. But what they wanted to show, if I remember correctly, was that in the course of human history, scientists have found there have been 4 major upheavals, you know, extinction events, or 3 major extinction events. There have been 4 magnetic North Poles. And what they're trying to show in the course of this film is that there have been cycles of worlds, and we are not the first world, so to speak, to be on Earth. And you can use that to account for the missing history. Take a look, please, at source number 5, which is the Midrash that starts it all off. Rabbi Yehuda Bar Simon said, it does not say there was evening, right, in Bereshit, in Genesis. It doesn't say Yehi Erev, so to speak. It says Vayehi, right? But and there was evening. So he says, and. Well, that means there's something first. Now, you could explain the and in many other ways, reading the text itself. Don't get hung up on this as a literal read. But he says, there's my clue. From here we see there was a history before this. Now, Bereshit Rabbah, just for reference, is published 1,800 years ago. The ideas in it are older than that. So again, this is not somebody who's dealing with evidence of dinosaurs. This is not somebody who's dealing with, you know, issues of cosmology. Rabbi Avahu said, this teaches that he, God, created world, or she if you like, created worlds and destroyed them until he created these. He said, these, meaning our world, these please me, the others did not please me. Rabbi Pinchas said, the source is not, and there was evening. Rabbi Avahu's source is, because the text says, and God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. What does it mean when God says this is very good? It means these are good, the others did not. These please me, the others did not please me. The other worlds that I created didn't please me. This goes back to the idea which we presented in which we presented last week when we talked about the cycle of 6,000 years, the idea that there is going to be a period of creation and then there's a period of destruction and then it starts again. And it fits with Talmudic teachings elsewhere as well. So that we posit the idea that there was some kind of an extinction event or multiple extinction events, and each time God started anew with a new population on Earth. This idea was drawn on by the period in the period of the Rishonim, early biblical scholars, early commentators to the Torah in medieval times. Take a look, please, at source number 6. Rabbi Avraham ibn Ezra is discussing the laws of Shemitah, which we've already mentioned, right? Shemitah, the sabbatical year, the idea that you plant for 6 years in Israel, and then the 7th year it lies fallow, and then you go through 7 cycles like that, and then after that you have a 50th year when also the land is supposed to be left fallow. So the verse calls the sabbatical year Shabbat Lashem, a sabbatical for God. So Ibn Ezra comments on that and says in number 6, a Shabbat for God, like the day of Shabbat. And the secret of the days of the world is hinted here. He doesn't want to tell you what this is. It's a mystical idea meant for initiates. But he says, once you understand the concept of the sabbatical year, you will recognize the history of the world within it. Well, the Kabbalists really took off with this. In the Spanish schools of that period of time, Ramban, Nachmanides in the 13th century did a lot with it. And then Rabbi Yitzhak of Akko, in source number 7, a student of Nachmanides, goes even further. And he says, on the idea that there is a period of 6,000 years and then a millennium when the world is laid waste, he says, this means there will be a time of absence of humans, fowl, and animals and their causes, meaning all the events that bring them into this world and that continue their existence, which will stop their activity and their continuity, and therefore they will need and depend upon something to reinstate them. Something's going to have to happen to restart life. God is going to have to create life anew each time, always on this planet. Now you'll see in source number 7 in the heading, I wrote Shuchat translation. If you flip the page for a second to the end, Dr. Rafael Shuchat wrote two articles on this topic in a journal put out by Yeshiva University called the Torah Umada Journal. The first one listed there is on attitudes towards cosmogony and evolution throughout this early period that we're now discussing. And then the second one was specifically about Rabbi Yitzchak Halevi Herzog, and we'll talk about him in a little bit. But both articles are available online, which meant I could cut and paste his translation instead of having to do my own, and that's why I'm crediting him in the line. But I recommend actually going to his articles themselves and reading through, because he has more to say here than I'm going to fit into an hour. And it's worth reading. Rafael Shuchat is a professor at Bar-Ilan, at Bar-Ilan University. So, Rabbi Yitzchak of Akko says, there are cycles of worlds living on this planet, and the cycles of worlds, each one is somehow an improvement on the previous one. Now, you'll still say, if it's 6,000 years per world, right? You still you need a lot of worlds to get to 13 billion, right? How many worlds are you talking about? However, by Yitzchak of Akko, again, 13th, 14th century, before anyone else has made any suggestion like this, comes up with an explanation for how these worlds work. Take a look at source number 8. He says, I have reason to write a great and divine secret which should really be hidden. I love it when someone starts like that. I shouldn't really be telling you this, but keep in mind, this comes from Otzar Chaim, which is an unpublished manuscript. It's been passed down all along, and we have the manuscript, but no one has actually published it for reasons. Well, initially, because it was Kabbalistic. Kabbalah, by definition, is supposed to be teacher to student, received tradition, and it's not supposed to be published. More recent years, maybe because there are problems with reading some parts of the manuscript, conflicts between manuscripts make it hard to work with. But to date, it has not, I believe it has not been published. But he says the following. Know that God's day is 1,000 of our years, right? We talked about that last week. From the verse from Tehillim, from Psalms, for in your sight 1,000 years are like yesterday that has passed. Right? We talked about that already before. Our year, meaning our solar year, is 365 days and a quarter. Therefore, the divine year above, meaning in heaven, is 365,250 years. The 250 he adds as an annotation in a later manuscript. So, because you know that the solar year is 365 and a quarter days. So, 365,250 years is 1 year for God. And then he says, and now I shall say something that needs meditation. It is that 100 years for the Holy One, blessed be He, are 36 times 150,000 of our years. And since we said that the year above is 365,250 years, calculate for 100 years and then for 1,000 years, and you will not need any more thought. Not because you fall asleep by that point. That's not what he means. But therefore, he says, our eyes can see that the world shall exist for a very long time, in the event that you don't want to do the math yourself. If each world is a 7,000-year period, 6,000 years that it's functional, and then 1,000 years of destruction, multiply 7,000 by 365, right, that's 7,000 years worth of days, and then multiply that by 1,000, because each day is 1,000 years, and what you end up is that each world is 2.5 billion years. Add to that the fact that the Kabbalists argued, and we'll see it shortly, that we are now in the fourth year, in the fourth world, and what you end up with is a number in the 10 billion year rage, written by somebody who would have been considered out of his mind in his day for making a suggestion like that. If you went around, now you know why it was unpublished. If you went around in the 13th century telling people that the world was 10 billion plus years old, they would have locked you up. That would have been it. The end of his Kabbalistic line, because he would have had no students. Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan wrote a lot about this, and he's the first place where I saw this idea presented. And the idea flourishes in Kabbalistic works until the 16th century. In the 16th century, it got the kiss of death. Imagine if, I don't know if Oprah is still a thing, but imagine if Oprah would have gone on her show and said, this book is terrible, don't bother reading it. Right? Actually, that might have made it more popular. I don't know. If people want to know what it is that she's saying, you know, that about. But the Ari, Rabbi Yitzchak Luria, was the head of the Kabbalistic school in Tzfat in the middle of the 16th century, and he rejected this idea entirely. He said the idea of multiple worlds creating and destroying is spiritual and not physical, and therefore it shouldn't be interpreted as Kabbalists had been interpreting it for hundreds of years. He did that. He rewrote the rules for Kabbalah, which is why the Kabbalah that his school taught is called Lurianic Kabbalah. It's his stamp, his tradition. But in recent years, this has become popular once again as a way to solve the age of the universe problem. Take a look, please, at source number 9, flip side of the page.
With all that math, does it add up to the right billion?
So it depends which world we're in the cycle. That's what will determine it. But if you go with 2.5 billion or so per world, then you really need us to be, I think, towards the end of the fifth, I think, in order to get exactly there. But they're still working out which billion we are anyway. Right? We went back to the NASA problem last week, where on the one hand, if you calculated based on the age of the stars, you got one number. If you calculated based on the speed with which the galaxies are traveling apart, you get another number. So I'm happy with anything that gets me, you know, north of 10 billion. I consider myself safe at that point. Dan, you were going to say?
No, I was just going to say I googled Torah on the age of the universe. And the first one from Ish Torah.
Yeah.
And the author explains the 50 million in terms of, 15 billion age of the universe in terms of Torah.
Yeah.
From thermodynamics, from Einstein's theory of relativity.
Right.
Everything. It's a fascinating thing.
So if you take a look at the flip side of the page, well, it's the side that you're on now, at the bottom, you will see I referenced two books there. One by Dr. Nathan Abiezer, and the other by Dr. Gerald Schrader. They're both professors in Israel. I would guess that the Aish article was written by Gerald Schrader.
Yes.
They go into ideas involving, in turn, either quantum physics or thermodynamics/relativity in order to try to explain why it is that the Torah would present something as being so short when in fact it's long. It has to do with all sorts of science, which I knew we were not going to get to here, but that's why I gave you the reference there for the titles. If you Google those, and apparently if you go to Aish on this, you will find explanations that fit those ideas as well. There is a lot more to be said with it. Yes? What were you going to say?
I see a contradiction here.
Yeah.
God is creating and making mistakes and creating again and making mistakes and creating again.
Yes.
It doesn't work for me.
Right. So here you have to deal with a problem that I'm going to come back to shortly. So I'm going to hold the question just for a couple of minutes because I want to go through a few more sources first. But we're going to have to come back to this, which is, what are the philosophical implications of this? What did this mean to the Kabbalists who didn't know there was an age of the universe problem? What was the point they were trying to make about what this universe is all meant to accomplish and what we are meant to be? So hold the question for a few minutes. I want to just get through a few sources first and then come back to it. Take a look at number 9, please. Number 9 Rabbi Yisrael Lipschitz. Rabbi Yisrael Lipschitz is best known for his commentary to the Mishnah. It's a work called Tiferes Yisrael. It appears in classic printings of the Mishnah. And you read that, and it's a very sober, straightforward read. But he was very into the science of his day, which was the middle of the 19th century. And so in his commentary to the Mishnah, you find little things stuck in about dinosaurs and fossils and things like that, explaining different discoveries in light of what he has learned. But this is from a separate work of his. It's called Or HaChaim. And he says, the Lord's secrets are for those who revere him. And that's a biblical verse. Sod Hashem li Rayav. For they have received the tradition that we are in the fourth world, which in order of the 7 days of creation parallels the fourth day in which God created the luminary bodies. Which is why they made a big deal about four magnetic north poles and three extinction events. Therefore, in this cycle, the light of Torah has arisen, which is the sun that lights up the entire world. Because what happens on the fourth day of creation? Sun, moon, and stars. So that's when the light of Torah has been introduced to the world. So even if the honor of the holy nation is at a low, the holy Torah stands as a luminous light on the horizon for the whole world. However, if the Torah is the large luminary of the day, right, because we find the creation of the large luminary and the small one. So the large one is the Torah. The small luminary is human reason that rules in this world. It too arises in this cycle, and in the coming years will reach heights previously unknown to the human mind. The moon's light becoming great as the sun, as it's predicted by the prophets. So he takes this idea, and he is already dealing with, in his day, he's already dealing with scientific discoveries which indicate the world is much older, and he goes back to this old idea and says, well, that's the solution. It's a cycle of worlds, and we are in the fourth in this series. Each of the sages who I'm about to bring you here takes this idea a step further. Rabbi Eliyahu ben Amozech in Italy, in source number 10, says the following. He's dealing with the idea of multiple worlds, and he's dealing with evolution. He says, nowadays we can even understand our sages of blessed memory literally. We do not need to sit in the shade of a parable, meaning I don't have to do what Maimonides did, where he said that you could just reinterpret Bereshit. He says, no, I'm good now. It has been proven by natural scientists that before this creation of matter, plants, and animals, there was another order to the world, a very different matter, plants, and animals. These worlds were literally destroyed, and the remains of their destruction we can still witness today in the belly of the earth. Fossils, as he understands them. All in accordance with the statement of Rabbi Yehuda Bar Simon, which is the statement that we saw about there being multiple worlds back in source number 5. Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch, probably more famous to people, I think, in general, lives in 19th century Germany, is a leading scholar trying to interpret and explain Judaism to people who, in his day, were rejecting it. And he's very skeptical about science in general and the way that it keeps changing, which is a thing we've talked about. But he says, I don't need to be dogmatic about how I believe things work. He says in number 11, Judaism is not frightened even by the hundreds of thousands and millions of years which the geological theory of the earth's development bandies about so freely. Judaism would have nothing to fear from that theory, even if it were based on something more than mere hypothesis, on the still unproven presumption that the forces we see at work in our world today are the same as those that were in existence, with the same degree of potency when the world was first created. He says, they have all these ideas and philosophies which, maybe they're true, but even if they are, I don't need to be afraid of them. Our rabbis, the sages of Judaism, discuss, and he quotes you in Midrash, the possibility that earlier worlds were brought into existence and subsequently destroyed by the Creator before He made our own earth in its present form and order. However, the rabbis never made the acceptance of this and similar possibilities an article of faith binding on all Jews. They were willing to live with any theory that did not reject the basic truth that, quote, every beginning is from God. As long as my story begins with God made, I can deal with everything else that somebody says. So what you see there, and there are others, if you go to the Shuchat article, the first one that I listed at the bottom, he brings you others as well. But they make the argument that we just have to go back to this old Midrashic source, and that will answer our problem. But now I go back to the question that Pesia asked, which is, what does this actually mean from a Jewish perspective? The idea that God creates the world and then destroys it. What does it say about our purpose? And what does it say about God? Why couldn't he get it right the first time? Right? What's this business of creating worlds and destroying them? What would... Did he?
By water.
He said by water. That leaves a whole bunch of other methods. V'lo yeh od mabul l'shachet ha'aretz. Right? That's the verse. There will no longer be through a flood. That's okay. I got other weapons. Make one president and you're good. What does this mean for us? What are sages who write this down trying to tell people in our day, or in their day for that matter, about creation, about the world?
No matter what, up to be like to us, basically, maybe. In our time, we'll think it's up to us to maintain that world.
It's predicated upon us achieving something.
Yes. I mean, destruction comes as a result of something going wrong in the world.
Right.
And if we can maintain it properly, it doesn't have a need for destruction.
So one way to look at it is, it's trying to say this world is conditional. Right? The world is conditional. If we are good, great. If not, then you go the way of those who have been destroyed before. Marilyn, you were going to say.
Is that a punishment?
Consequence, at any rate.
I
don't know if I call it a punishment.
Well, it sounds like you're going to get punished.
Really, action and reaction.
Right, action and reaction, yeah.
So do you punish many for the sins of the few?
Well, ask God at Sodom, right? But that's... I call your attention to a point that Rabbi Lipschitz made in number 9, in which he said that the light of Torah only arises in world number 4. What this suggests, and especially if I want to blend it with scientific discovery, evolution, and so on, is that there's a growth that has to take place, and that God starts with life from point zero, so to speak, and it evolves and grows, and in each of those succeeding worlds, it gets closer to a state in which it can appreciate Torah and fulfill something, but it's not quite there yet. And only in the world that we are inhabiting do you have for the first time the tools for this kind of perfection, because all the stages of creation, and if you want to go, you know, in the fossil record and say, well, they were Cro-Magnon or they were whatever, they weren't ready for Torah. Now we're at a stage where we're ready for Torah, and we're given that as our means of growth, with the possibility that we're going to achieve it, and with the possibility that we're not going to achieve it, and then the consequences will be what they're going to be. So it's not so much a question of, are you going to punish the few? It's a question of, is this world going to achieve what it's meant to achieve? That's where I would go with it.
Following the Torah, that's the ultimate goal. Once we all, in the universe, accept that concept, that idea, then we will preserve that world.
Unless there's something else that we're meant to grow into after this. In other words, maybe, you know, that's the height of what we perceive based on where we are, but a new dimension is added in the next round.
It will still be Torah.
Yes. But it's going to be something in addition. Something else. Something deeper. Something with a greater understanding. What that means, I don't know. But yeah, that's the read. I mean, it's hard to wrap your mind around this. Not for me to wrap my mind around this, at any rate. But I think that's the message that they're trying to convey. It's trying to give people a bigger picture. The universe is not all about my little world. It's a much bigger trajectory. And we are along the way. We've gotten to a certain point, but there's a long way we still have to go. That's when you're Rabbi Yitzchak of Akko, you're not thinking about resolving science. When you're Rabbi Yitzchak of Akko, you're trying to teach people what we're meant to accomplish in this world. Bless you. For those who are at the course we did in June on Kabbalah, you'll recall that I explained at the time that Torah, the visible Torah, not this mystical tradition, but the visible Torah explains what is expected of me in this world. What am I supposed to do? Kabbalah tries to give you the wiring behind the walls, how it all works. And that's what he's trying to do. He's trying to give you this bigger picture of the development of the universe. Stephen, I'm going to ask you to hold for a second, just for more than a second, because I want to get through one more idea here. This, you know, what we've seen are three different approaches. One approach that says, don't worry about the age of the universe or anything else. We can reinterpret Bereishit to fit it. The second view that says, no, I have a passage in the Talmud that says God creates the world as a complete world looking like it's supposed to look. Had it grown like this all along? Third approach is also drawn on classic sources. I have a midrash that says there have been multiple worlds, and that was even played out to be billions of years. Last approach is an approach of rejection. And the when I say rejection, I don't mean outright rejection of science, but saying maybe there's a minority view that will agree with what we've been saying all along. Maybe there's somebody somewhere who's on our side. Rabbi Yitzhak Halevi Herzog was the chief rabbi of the State of Israel after the moving ahead from the time of Rav Kook. He was a scientist in training. He was a chemist specifically, at least a master's, if not a doctorate, in chemistry. And with his scientific training, he's approaching what the world is telling him and trying to come up with a way to deal with it. His English was great. He was a rabbi in Ireland before he came to Israel. And in source number 12, we see a letter he wrote to Dr. Emanuel Velikovsky. If you're familiar with Velikovsky, Velikovsky claimed that there were ways to explain the biblical miracles based on the movement of the planets. He has one work called Worlds in Collision. He had numerous books and papers like this. He was very controversial. Much of the scientific world rejected outright what he had to say. But he believed that you could account for biblical events based on the movement of the planets. So Rabbi Herzog is fascinated when he reads this. And he says, I have to know more. And so he writes the letter you see in number 12. How can the Torah chronology be scientifically defended in view of the eons which science postulates for the existence of man upon this earth? There is, of course, the well-known Midrash, Bone Olamot U'Machrivan. That's the Midrash of that God created worlds and destroyed them. He says, yeah, I know about that Midrash. But this can only help if we assume that Machrivan does not mean annihilation. Meaning, he says, maybe the Midrash means God created a world, demolished everything, and started from scratch. It's not the fossil record that you see. It's something brand new each time. So that we can assume that fossils of man, asserted by science to be so many hundreds of thousands of years old, are relics of a previous earth. Yet anthropology seems to assert upon internal evidence that the present man is already hundreds of thousands of years old. He says, I don't accept that. Because what about the world we're in right now? Our state as human beings is hundreds of years, thousands of years old, he says. Nevertheless, Aldous Huxley speaks of 12,000 years as the age of civilized man upon this earth. Even this is far too much for Torah chronology, less than 6,000 years. It has been tried to fix 6,000 as the age since the discovery by man of agriculture. Maybe that's where Adam comes in. Of course, strictly literal interpretation of the Pentateuchal text is out of the question, because that puts Adam and Eve as the first, without any, you know, antecedents. But superliterary interpretation should be resorted to only when reason absolutely rules the literary sense being utterly impossible. He says, I'm not going to be willing to take this as a parable unless I absolutely can't take it literally. By the way, I see in your epilogue to Volume 1 that you are satisfied that the planets and their satellites are only a few thousand years old. Do you then accept the Torah chronology literally? Are you then at least not convinced from the internal evidence of the history of man upon the earth that man has been here for already millions of years? With the numbers of the human race and its technical perfection, writing, etc., not militate in your opinion against the acceptance of a less than 6,000 years date for man here? He's giving him arguments not to believe in a 6,000-year-old world. He's saying, look, we developed writing, we developed language, we developed society, we have a diversity of species, and so on. Can you really believe this? And he wants Velikovsky to say yes, in order to then be able to say, see that? Our account is right in the original, and I don't have to read it as a parable, and I don't have to talk about worlds being destroyed and all that. Even if it's just a minority view, which I wouldn't accept in a halachic context necessarily, right? The one view against the world. He's going to be happy if in the scientific world there is somebody who is willing to say, I see the evidence and I agree with the classic chronology. And so that's another approach which says, I'd rather not have to resort to reinterpretation. I'd rather not have to resort to going back to old sources and saying, well, this actually supports where things are. I'd like to find a scientist who's on my side. So those are some of the approaches to this issue of the age of the universe. And you see how it plays out based, I hope, on what we saw in the first couple of weeks. These different ways of looking at the evidence that's in front of us and trying to satisfy the different approaches, whether reinterpreting Torah, revisiting earlier sources, or finding a scientist who's going to be on our side. There's more to say here. I hope to send out a digest later today of what we've done. And next week, God willing, we move on to Talmudic medicine and the question of whether that's a good idea or bad idea in our own day. Thank you.